I'm Michael Goldfarb, in for Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. In the Holy Land, there's history around every corner, and it always matters. Last week, Palestinian researcher Khalil Shakaki was attacked in his office in Ramallah. He was about to announce an astounding finding. His recent public opinion survey found that only 1 in 10% of Palestinian refugees would move back to Israel if given the chance. His attackers pelted him with eggs and called him a traitor. Defenders of the right of Palestinian refugees to return to their former homes in what is now Israel say this right is fundamental. Many Israelis reject the right of return, saying that the return of millions of Palestinians would completely alter what they see as the Jewish nature of Israel. As Prime Ministers Abbas and Sharon head to Washington to discuss the future implementation of the roadmap, we'll talk today about the unfinished business of Palestinian refugees. Connection listeners, how does the Palestinian refugee problem figure in the perpetual crisis in the Middle East? What might be a solution that both sides could live with? And is there a just way to deal with competing claims to the same land? Call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And listeners, there is no topic that the Connection covers that brings forth more intense and emotional debate than this one. And we will all try and talk about this topic, our guests, our callers, with reason, which is sometimes sorely lacking in that discussion. Joining me today are two scholars who have thought and written quite a bit about the right of return. But first, I'd like to go to the West Bank, to Ramallah, to Ghassan Al-Khatib, who is the Palestinian Minister of Labor. Mr. Khatib, hello.
Hi.
Listen, the results of Khalil Shakaki's report, did they surprise you?
Well, actually, it didn't. It was my personal experience. I always thought that most of the Palestinians would insist on the right to return. Very little of them are going to choose one of the too many different possible solutions, is the return, because others might like to be compensated.
Okay, Ghassan Al-Khatib, we're having trouble with your line. It's breaking up quite badly. So I'm going to go to a recording of an interview with a gentleman in Sidon, Lebanon, Gaber Suleiman, who's a Palestinian refugee. We're going to try and get you back up on another line. Anyway, earlier today, I spoke with Gaber Suleiman, who is a Palestinian refugee living in Sidon in Lebanon, and he left Israel he was born in 1945 and left in 1948, and this is what he told me.
My family fled 1948 with other Palestinians who fled the war in 1948 to different Arab countries like Jordan, Syria, Lebanon, etc.
In Israel, where did you live?
Yeah, my origin village is called Tal at-Turmus. It belonged to, before 1948, belonged to Al-Majdal province, what is known now Ashkelon.
Does the village itself, the buildings, do they still exist?
As far as I know, there is only one home at my village. It's the home of my grandmother, actually, because my elder brother visited the village after 1967, after the June War, and he informed me that the only house is still, which is still exists, is my grandmother's home, because it's built of stone. You know, most of the villages before 1948, Palestinian villages, were made of mud blocks and such like materials.
After all this time, do you still have things with you from your family's home?
Actually, what we have only the land certification. We still maintain these certifications that prove our property in Palestine. And these certifications were issued during the British mandate, according to the Ottoman laws, you know, land property laws. So we still have this land certification.
If you were offered compensation for the stone house in Tal al-Turmus, would you accept compensation?
Yeah. You know, this is a very important question, because we accept, we should come back to the resolution 194, General Assembly, United Nations Resolution 194, affirms the right of Palestinian refugees to at least two rights, two types of compensation. The first type is payment to refugees not choosing to return to their homes. The second, payment for the loss of or damage to movable and unmovable property and psychological suffering as well. But this choice could only be offered when return faces the refugees as a reality. When the possibility of repatriation doesn't exist, the choice equally doesn't exist. So this is the way how I understand compensation. First is right of return. My right of return is the priority, and I have the right to return and the right to compensation. But on the principle of individual refugee choice.
Gaber Suleiman, thank you very, very much.
Thank you very much.
I was speaking earlier on a phone line to Gaber Suleiman, who lives in Sidon in Lebanon. We have been unable to get Ghassan al-Khatib back on a phone line. He was in Ramallah. Apologies to him. Let me bring in my main guests for this hour. Joining us on a line from Israel is Benny Morris, whose first book, The Birth of the Palestinian Refugee Problem, changed dramatically what Israelis and others know about the flight of Palestinians from the land of Israel during the 1948 war, and his subsequent and recent articles in the New York Review of Books about what really caused the breakdown of the Camp David peace process have also been controversial. Benny Morris, hello.
Hi.
And joining us on the line from Washington is Shibli Talhami, who is the Anwar Sadat Professor for Peace and Development at the University of Maryland and the author of The Stakes, America and the Middle East, The Consequences of Power and the Choice for Peace. Shibli Talhami, hello.
Hello.
Let me first turn to you, Benny Morris. We heard Gaber Suleiman in Lebanon talking about Resolution 194, guaranteeing the Palestinians a right of return. Now, for years, those of us who follow this story had been keenly aware of UN Resolution 232, which calls for the Israelis to withdraw from the territories occupied after 1967. 194 refers to the events of 1948. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
Well, just a comment on 242. The United Nations resolution at the end of the Six-Day War, it actually stipulates Israeli withdrawal in exchange for peace, not just withdrawal. But relating to the resolution 194 of the General Assembly of the United Nations from December 1948, okay. Suleiman somehow misrepresented it. The resolution endorses a right of return or compensation. It provides the refugee with the right to return, or if he prefers not to return to his original home, to receive compensation instead. It, of course, offers nothing in terms of psychological compensation or compensation in addition to a return. It just speaks of the right of return or accepting compensation. The Palestine Liberation Organization and the Palestinian Authority, its present successor, if you like, organization, insist on Israel and the world's acceptance of this right of return. And this is where we stand at the moment. Suleiman, incidentally, one other thing, was very careful in responding to your question not to say that he rejects or waives the right of return. He said, I want compensation, I want the right of return. He didn't say, I will take compensation instead of the right of return.
Shibli Talhami, you're Palestinian.
I'm an American of Palestinian origin.
Would you understand how someone who was born after 1948, grew up in another country, America, Canada, Switzerland, would feel that they were entitled to a right of return?
Well, you know, when you look at this issue, you have to look at it in the context of several dimensions. You can't look at it as a single-dimension issue. There is an emotional dimension, emotional, psychological. There is a legal dimension. There is a practical dimension. There is an issue of collective rights, an issue of individual rights. And so unless you look at it in all these dimensions, it's very, very difficult to come to grips with it or even come to a settlement that would be satisfying to both sides. And on the psychological side, it is obviously a central issue to both Israelis and Palestinians. On the Palestinian side, it is clear that, you know, it's hard to tell someone who left their home in 1948 and they still have the keys and the contracts that don't have a right to go to their home. It's very hard for them, especially since they've defined the struggle over decades. In that regard, they've suffered through refugee camps, they've paid a heavy price, they've been homeless for a long time, they've generated, you know, the children have grown in miserable conditions, have been always received the explanation that that's because they, you know, are awaiting return. It's very hard for them to tell them all of that is absolutely useless, all of the what they've done is wrong, now it's all over. On the Israeli side, obviously, the psychology is one pertaining to responsibility. They don't want, if you acknowledge that, it's not just the practical issue of return that would change the character of the state. There is also the sense of then who's responsible, and that issue of responsibility becomes critical. And so there's that dimension, which is extremely important. There's the legal dimension. That is, by acknowledging a right, do you not then face the possibility of floodgate of suits? And obviously the Israelis have to worry about that.
Shibli Tilhami, let me interrupt you for a second and ask the same question I asked Ghassan al-Khatib. Does Khalil Shikaki's research surprise you in any way? That one in ten of the people he surveyed, and I think that the survey was only in the West Bank and Gaza, that only one in ten people would actually exercise this right. Does that surprise you?
Well, obviously the extent of it was somewhat surprising. We had no idea. Nobody has ever done this research, and I have no reason to doubt it because, I mean, Mr. Shikaki does very serious work, and so I think it's probably correct. But I tell you, the gist of it was not surprising to me. I think it is clear, I've always believed, that when you, if you address the psychological issue of people thinking they're right and they have a moral right and so forth, that when you come to the practical implementation, given the idea that is put forth here that you're going to have two states, one for the Palestinians, one for the Jews, that the vast majority of refugees would choose not to return to Israel as Israeli citizens, even if they were able to, So I think that part I'm not surprised by. It's nice to have it confirmed, nice to know the differences between refugees in the West Bank and Lebanon in Jordan. There were significant differences among those refugees, according to those surveys. But the general sense, I think, is right, and it sort of, it does clearly open up the possibility of a negotiated settlement.
Shibli Tilhami, I'm going to interrupt you there. We're coming up to the break. That's what the music means. I want to pick you up after the break on how the right of return, the sense of being a refugee, has defined Palestinian identity these last 55 years. And we'll talk to Benny Morris about how this right of return affected recent negotiations. 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is The Connection. I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is The Connection. We're talking in this hour about the Palestinian right of return, which is the ultimate hurdle to be crossed if there's ever to be peace in the Middle East. 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK, are the numbers to call, is the number to call if you want to join in this conversation. We're talking with Shibli Tilhami, Professor for Peace and Development at the University of Maryland. And we're also talking in this hour with Benny Morris, who teaches history at Ben-Gurion University in Be'er Sheva in Israel. Benny Morris, were you surprised by the findings of Khalil Shikaki's poll?
Well, I haven't actually seen the poll. I've just heard people talk about what it says. But let me make a distinction here, which wasn't made. As far as I know, the Shikaki poll was done in the West Bank.
It was also done in Lebanon and in Jordan, by the way. It was not done in Syria, but it included Lebanon and Jordan.
That Shibli Tahame.
And the Gaza Strip.
And Gaza
and the West Bank, yes.
Whatever the poll came up with, I think one has to draw a clear line of distinction between several categories of refugees. Simply put, the Palestinian refugees living in the West Bank, them and their descendants, are better placed, materially at least, and perhaps in the future in terms of citizenship, than those in Lebanon and Syria who do not enjoy citizenship of any country. They live as guests, if you like, in the House of Lebanon, but not as citizens, and the same applies to Syria. And the same applies to the Gaza Strip refugees who did not enjoy Egyptian citizenship when Egypt occupied the place and have not enjoyed citizenship since. Those are one category, and they, for them, the return, the right of return and the possibility of return, I think, is uppermost in their minds, to get out of a place where they do not own land, where they do not have citizenship, and often do not enjoy employment, and to get back to this idealized village or town from pre-1948 Palestine. The situation isn't as acute for those in the East Jordan and who enjoy Jordanian citizenship, and perhaps those in the West Bank as well. That's one point I wanted to make. Another point, I think, which is important, Shibli talked about the psychological problem for Palestinians giving up the right of return, and I can see that for sure, though we must remember we're talking not mostly about refugees, but about children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren of refugees, not many of the original refugees. In fact, the 700,000 from 1948 are still alive. The vast majority of the 4 million they say are refugees are not refugees at all. They're just children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren of refugees. For them, I can understand at least the psychological problem of giving up the right of return. But when he was talking about Israel and its psychological problem, I think he's off base, Shibli. The problem isn't one of responsibility, and if the right of return is implemented or negotiated, Israelis will begin to feel guilt or not guilt and so on. That's the way he's posing it. The real problem for Israelis of the right of return is a very concrete, very political, and very demographic, if you like, military problem, and that is that the right of return and the flooding of Israel by 4 million refugees will instantly not just change the character of the state from Jewish into Arab or Muslim, but destroy the state. That's the point. It's not a matter just of change of character, it's a matter of the imminent destruction of the state, which Israelis feel burdens them when they contemplate the possibility of a right of return.
Shibli Tahame.
Well, I actually don't disagree with that. I said both. I didn't say one. It's both of these things. So, you know, I don't know what the point of disagreement is here. But the point on the difference between the West Bank, Lebanon, and Jordan refugees, I think, is important. Actually, Khalil Shaqaqi has done exactly that. He's actually broken down the differences between different segments of the refugees, and did find differences very much along the lines of that Benny suggested, and particularly the ones pertaining to who is more inclined to want to go to their original homes, or at least to move to Israel as citizens of the state of Israel. In fact, it turns out that a greater percentage among the Lebanese refugees would do that, as opposed to the West Bank and Jordanian refugees. Still a minority, but still a greater number than among those in the West Bank and those in Jordan. And correctly, I think, as Benny identified, more of the Palestinian refugees in Jordan have a sense of Jordanian identity. On the identity question, which was also tested in that survey, clearly a good number of refugees, Palestinian refugees in Jordan, do have a Jordanian identity, and in that sense are very comfortable staying as citizens in Jordan.
Shibli, I was in Baqa camp at the outskirts of Amman back in February, and I found there that the sense of, at least in talking to me and working through a translator, that there is this sense still in a place like Baqa that I am a refugee. And I might be talking to somebody who's 20 years old, whose father was also born in Baqa or in the vicinity. I am a refugee. That is how I define myself. We Palestinians are refugees. And I'd like to ask you about this sense of why, you know, 55 years on from the events of 1948, three generations on from those events, that it seems to be an essential part of Palestinian identity to define yourself as a refugee who someday will go home.
Yeah, and that's actually even more true about Lebanon. There is a narrative, obviously, that the refugees have had. Every father explained to their children, every mother, why they are in such misery, why they live in such conditions. And it's all been tied to this history. And obviously, it's not just a history in vacuum because, you know, the Arab-Israeli conflict has been alive all these years. It's not like it's been dormant or it's been over and therefore still they're not putting that away. So it's in the context of constant conflict for Israelis and Arabs, Israelis and Palestinians over these years. And the narrative has played a very important role in shaping that identity. But in Lebanon, I think there is a humanitarian dilemma that is huge, even aside from the identity. I think that people have not been citizens, have not been accepted. The Palestinians there live in miserable conditions. And frankly, a lot of that blame, while obviously, Israeli leaders, Arab leaders, they all have to blame. Some of the governments in the Arab world obviously have not been helpful in at least addressing that humanitarian aspect. And I think Jordan, unlike many, in fact, offered Palestinian citizenships and many accepted it. But that didn't end the Palestinian identity, even for those who became citizens. It may have weakened it somewhat, but clearly this notion of link to the land, to the original homes, the sense, the right of return as part of a collective identity remains.
800-423-8255. 800-423-TALK. Mark is on the line from Brookline, Massachusetts.
Good morning. I wonder if your guests could comment on the general notion of a right of return and if there's historical precedent for such a right and if, say, during the World War, after the World Wars, such a right was ever exercised.
Benny Morris.
Well, in the course of World War II, many French citizens fled Paris as the German armies swept down on the city. And they did return to the city. Nobody questioned their right and nobody blocked their return. On the other hand, refugees from Turkey moving back to Greece and Greeks moving back to Turkey, Turkish Greeks moving back to Turkey in the years 1920-21 or 1947, you've got Hindus moving from Pakistan to India and Muslims moving from what became India into Pakistan, the right of return wasn't recognized. So it's up in the air whether there is always a right of return. The problem is especially acute, I would say, in the Israeli-Palestinian context, in the political and military senses, that if Israel had it allowed the Palestinians to return in 1949, or were it to allow them to return in the future, the question is, what sort of citizens would they be? I mean, in 1948, they had fought against the creation of the State of Israel. I can understand why they did that, but that turned them into enemies. Once they fled the country, would it have made sense for Israelis to allow them back as a fifth column? And the same, in effect, applies, demographically speaking, today. You allow back 4 million Palestinian refugees into a country which has 1 million Arabs and 5 million Jews. Almost instantly, you have an Arab majority, means the destruction of the State of Israel as we know it. So the right of return may have historical precedence, may not have historical precedence, but the question may be unique in this particular context.
Well, I think that, there were many refugees who returned, and think about even just in this context, obviously Jews are, have a sense of a right of return to a historic land after many centuries. And there are refugees who haven't returned, obviously. But I think in the context here is no one can take someone's right away to their home. What you can do is you can settle claims in ways that are realistic. And I think if you look at any negotiated settlement between Israel and the Palestinians in the foreseeable future has to be based on a nationalist framing of the conflict. That is, that you're reaching a historic compromise over the land by satisfying Jewish nationalism and Palestinian nationalism a state for the Palestinians, a state that would be Jewish. And if you start with that as the basis of a negotiated settlement, it does limit the options of how the right of return claims would have to be settled. And I think that, I think, is a starting point for negotiations. That is to say that, that whatever settlement of a right of return, it has to be done in the context that would be compatible with the maintaining Israel as a Jewish state side by side with a state that satisfies Palestinian nationalism.
Mark, I
completely agree with that. I think Shibli is definitely right on this, that any compromise solution must have, and this is what we're really talking about when you translate this into a reality, must have a compensatory response to the Palestinian refugee problem. In other words, there must be compensation, a proper rehabilitation in countries where they are, or in the West Bank Palestinian state when and if it emerges. But a massive return of Palestinian refugees to Israel, which would undermine Israel and undermine the stability of the region indefinitely, cannot be the basis. And that's my problem with the Palestinian Authority's demand of the right of return to be agreed upon in principle, because once they open that and demand that as a principle which must be agreed upon by the world community and by Israel, they're opening the door to a return to Israel of masses of refugees, and that, of course, is contrary to what both Shibli and myself see as a possible solution to this conflict.
Okay, well Benny Morris and Shibli Tohami, you both have very quickly and easily come to some kind of common ground. Yet this particular issue is, as you were just saying, Benny, raised over and over again in previous negotiations, particularly in the last decade during the Oslo process and subsequent attempts to keep the peace process going. Shibli Tohami, why is it that the Palestinian Authority has continued to strike on this and I guess fail to begin to prepare Palestinians, particularly those living in the West Bank and Gaza, for the reality that the right of return may not happen if there's to be some kind of peace?
Well, let me tell you, I think, my take on this. I do not believe that this is the issue that resulted in the collapse of the Camp David negotiations in 2000. I think this was an issue that was never really fully addressed, and I do think that each side was holding on to their lost cards to be played because they have very little leverage, particularly the Palestinians had very little leverage on some of the issues, and this was a huge lever in their hand. And I do think that they were, at some point going to exercise that as a lever. And this, to this day, it's a critical negotiating card in their hand. But at the same time, I think it's a real issue. It's not just a negotiating issue because it's a very tricky one to handle because of the psychological dimension. As we have said, maybe surveys show that most Palestinians would not go even if they had a choice, but would not go back to Israel. But the reality of it is that there is a psychological dimension that you need to satisfy that in any formula that would acknowledge some kind of principle. The Israelis don't want to do it because if you do it, as Benny said, it would open up the floodgates. So you have to do both at the same time to say, here's the settlement and here's the principle and that's final. And in order to do that, it has to be part of a final settlement. They're not at that point yet. So I think there is room for it. Having said that, there are also difficulties still there. A Palestinian authority, as an authority speaking on behalf of collective rights of the Palestinians, could certainly write an agreement with Israel and says, we as a state no longer will have any claim to any part of Israel. We do not have, as a state, a claim to any part of Israel. We do not have a claim any our citizens wanting to go into Israel. We do not have a collective claim vis-a-vis Israel. But the Palestinian Authority simply cannot speak for an individual refugee who has a title to a house in Jaffa, who may not want to be part of this collective deal. It's like a class action deal, where if you're out of it,
does it not have a duty as the sole, the sole negotiating power for the Palestinian people, a duty just to lead public opinion a bit?
No question. And I think that we have discovered, particularly in the 1990s during the Camp David, during the Oslo process, that one of the failings of both Israelis and Palestinians was that they hadn't prepared the public. And I think that's a fair critique, both of the Palestinian Authority and the Israeli government. For that matter, the Israeli government, on the question of Jerusalem, had to, do all of whatever the preparation they did during the Camp David negotiations themselves, because no preparation was done on this particular issue among the public, and certainly the Palestinians have not done enough preparation. They're going to have to do it, and I think, frankly, if there was a lesson to have been learned from the 1990s, and there are many, but on this particular issue, the gap between the public and the governments, where the negotiators themselves may have known what the space of negotiations is, they've never conveyed that to their public, and it made it very, very difficult for them to scramble in the end.
Shibley, I'm going to interrupt and say the number again, 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Hillel is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I think one of the most disturbing aspects of the poll taken by Mr. Shikaki, which hasn't been mentioned so far, is that 13% of the refugee families polled, which amounts to roughly 435,000 people, rejected any kind of solution at all other than a military one. In addition to the 95% of those polled who wanted compensation in addition to the right of return. Now, I think this is a deal killer.
But Hillel, I'm wondering, do you have a suggestion, we are coming up to the break, about what a reasonable solution might be?
Well, I think the reasonable solution is what every Israeli government has been open to in the last 50 years, and basically that is compensation. Israel actually did resettle around 50,000 families under the family reunification policy in the 1950s, and it has continued up to this day to be open to the policy of compensation. But if there are 400,000 people who reject any kind of peaceful compromise, this doesn't bode well for the future.
Hillel, thanks for your call. We'll be taking up the point of whether there's been sufficient leadership to bring Palestinians around to the notion that there may not be a real return. And we'll be talking about other possible solutions with our guests, Benny Morris, historian in Israel, Shibley Telhami, professor of peace and development at the University of Maryland, and you, our listeners, the number to call, 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Is there a just solution for the competing claims on the lands called Palestine, called Israel? I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is The Connection. I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is The Connection. We're talking in this hour about the Palestinian right of return, a recent poll conducted in the West Bank, Gaza, and the countries that border, with the exception of Syria, those areas of Palestinians showed that 1 in 10 Palestinians would actually exercise their right of return. It was a controversial poll, and it led to demonstrations outside the pollster's office. We're talking about this. This is new news from that region, and we're talking about it with Shibley Telhami, who's in Washington. He is the Anwar Sadat Professor for Peace and Development at the University of Maryland. And we're also talking with Benny Morris, who's on a line from Israel, and he is the author of The Birth of the Palestinian Refugee Problem. Benny Morris, just before we went to the break, we were hearing about the idea of compensation, but also the idea of 13% of those surveyed in this poll absolutely rejected any compromise on the right of return.
I would tend to doubt this figure. I think that the figure is probably closer to 90%, the real figure. I think that 90% of Palestinians worldwide, and especially perhaps 100% in Lebanon, Syria, and the Gaza Strip, insist on the Palestinian right of return and Israel's and the world's acceptance of it. But let me turn to another point made by Shibley, and that was he drew a sort of an equivalence between the Israeli and Palestinian leadership's non-preparation of their publics for the concessions which are necessary for peace, if ever there is to be peace. And I think he's misleading the audience. I think the Israeli public partly by Palestinian actions, partly by the pointers of their leaders, have been prepared and are prepared to make the concessions necessary for peace. He mentioned Jerusalem. I think the Israeli public at the end of Barak's term of office was willing to concede, as was the government, half of Jerusalem in exchange for peace. The problem of preparation of publics for peace and for the concessions necessary for peace is, I think, almost solely on the Palestinian side. That, simply put, the Palestinian leadership has not only not prepared their public for the possibility of giving up the right of return, but they have not prepared their public for really accepting the existence of the state of Israel. This is the problem of legitimacy of Israel. So long as this is not addressed frontally, publicly, consistently by the Arab Palestinian leadership, the public will not go along with a deal which includes major compromises. That's one point. Another point I wanted to make was regarding Camp David. Shibley brushed aside the importance of the right of return as an issue at the Camp David talks, and he's right technically. He's completely wrong in my view, in essence. What I mean is the subject wasn't discussed because the Palestinians refused to budge on the right of return, and the Israelis said, well, there's obviously then nothing to discuss. The subject was always on the table, under the table, around the table. Everybody understood that it has to be faced, and the only way it can be faced is that the Palestinians will have to, in the end, give up this insistence on the right of return and accept compensation instead if there is to be a deal.
Shibley Tahami, quick comeback, well, and then we have some calls.
Yeah. First of all, I'm not really sure about what this equivalence business is. I always sort of puzzled by people who talk about the equivalence or non-equivalence and nonsense of that sort. But the reality of it is that the issue of Jerusalem was not faced publicly by every Israeli government insisted full sovereignty over all of Jerusalem, really up until they went to Camp David, and Camp David had opened up. But up until then, clearly there was no preparation, and whether or not the Israeli public moved along. Well, and I think in the right of return, ultimately when the Palestinian Authority plays it, I think it will, there will be less of a need than one thinks. Because look at what we're facing right now. So I think it's a question of exercising leadership. It never got to that point, and in any case, you know, the Camp David failure is a big issue to discuss. But I want to go back to this percentage of rejectionist among Palestinians. No, I'm not surprised that there would be 13% people rejecting absolutely a deal, and maybe even bigger in some places. And it does disturb me. I think that obviously you don't want to have any major significant opposition to a deal which we know is the only deal that could be had. But I think minorities are opposition are always going to be there. You do have a significant minority among Israelis who believes in expelling Palestinians from their homes as a possible solution. It's disturbing, but it doesn't bother me if it remains to be a minority, and then you have a majority that is reflected by official positions. It could be contained. So in that sense, that I think is less disturbing than may first appear. On the compensation issue, by the way, I think the issue is not just compensation, because there is the compensation for property, which obviously is important, and ultimately there will be a big negotiation related to that. But I think pertaining to the compensation for political rights, I mean, people are not only giving up the properties, but giving up the right to go and live in Israel. And I think in that sense, what you have to have is a package which offers people choices. It can't be seen to be imposed. That is, you can't say, here's what you're going to do and that's all you're going to have. What you're going to say is, you're going to say, you have five options and here are the options. And which one do you choose among those five options you have that include compensation and political settlement?
Shibley, I'm going to jump in and interrupt you because now we're getting into a negotiating session, and maybe there'll be another connection where we actually try and negotiate this in real diplomatic language. But we have some other calls, 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. David is calling from Providence, Rhode Island.
Yes, hi, thank you. In terms of the issue of the leadership preparation in anticipation of a possible settlement, what has always befuddled me is why historical precedent, isn't cited by the Palestinians recognize the leadership of the Palestinians, recognizing that right of return has been given up. There was the exchange in the formation of India and Pakistan, which was a clear exchange of populations to settle a dispute. There have been other instances of peoples displaced from lands in which financial compensation has been the model. And I don't hear any discussion of that being a basis for the current situation. Instead, you hear the leadership now. I'm not talking about the population. You hear the leadership talking in adamant and absolute terms that they will not give up the right of physical return. And it just seems utterly obstructionist because they must know it's a deal breaker.
David, I'm going to formulate that as a question for Benny Morris. As a historian, Benny, is there a legitimate connection between the way Pakistan and India settled their various border disputes? They've still got one big one outstanding with nukes facing off against each other in Kashmir. But is there something to be said about other models to look at in the various post-colonial border disputes that happened around the world?
Well, David talked about an exchange of population, meaning that in our context that the Palestinians must give up their right of return if there is to be a settlement. And I basically agree with this, but I'd like to expand it a little. What occurred in some perspectives, you can certainly see, in one perspective, you can certainly see it this way. In 1948 was, in effect, an exchange of population. In 1948, 700,000 Palestinians fled or were driven from their homes by Israel. And about 500,000-600,000 Jews who lived in Arab lands came into Israel in 48, 49, and the following years. And in this sense, there was an exchange of population of Jews and Arabs moving back and forth between the Arab states and what became Israel. In that sense, that if you see that as the comparison, that follows the model of Pakistan and India and follows the model of Turkey and Greece in the early 1920s. Unfortunately, as far as I know, Palestinians do not accept this as a model. And they say all that happened was 700,000 Palestinians left or were driven from their homes and are not being allowed back, and do not take any account or any interest in what happened to the Jews who were, of course, deprived of their property and basically driven out of the Arab countries.
Shibli Tohami.
Well, you know, I think there are a lot of models, and I think, frankly, this issue was never fully negotiated. It should have been. And part of the problem in the Oslo agreements is that all of the final status issues were postponed, and everybody thought of them as levers in their hands, and even preparation of public seemed to be considered to be giving away a lever, because if you prepare your public, then you say, all right, so you can give this up, then you can't play it to extract more concessions on other final issues, settlement issues. So there was something really structurally wrong in the negotiations, and I think Benny is really underplaying that. I mean, when you look at the kind of asymmetry of power and the way the negotiations were structured in Oslo, I think this issue was never discussed in the way it should have been discussed, including putting on the table all sorts of issues, all sorts of possibilities, all sorts of ideas to open it up for negotiation. I think it's going to have to happen.
Shibli Tohami in Washington, Benny Morris in Israel. I'm going to take one last call from Ned in Framingham, Massachusetts. He thinks he has a solution. Ned.
Yes, the solution should be an option for the refugees of returning to Israel or living in a Palestinian state or being resettled as first-class citizens in Arab countries or going to the West. And under the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, all Palestinians have the right to return to their homeland. Israel needs to recognize that in principle. And even if 2 million refugees wanted to return, which would be 50%, not 10%, there would be more Israeli Jews than there would have been in 1948 if the Palestinians hadn't fled. So you can't justify the expulsion of people, ethnic cleansing, on the basis of what happened in India and Pakistan. That's a deal breaker. Israel has to recognize international law and UN resolutions, and the refugees have every right to demand their human rights.
But what about the reality, the historical and political reality? If 2 million Palestinians, or 3 million, or 4 million come back to Israel, there will be no Israel. Doesn't that deter you in any way?
We still have a Jewish majority, and it's a binational state de facto now.
No, you'd have a Jewish
majority in 1948. In 1948, Israel Jews were around 52% of the population, and the Palestinians were to have first-class citizenship under UN partition plan.
Ned, hold on one second. You've got the wrong numbers,
but if the Palestinians came back, even if temporarily they were a slightly small minority, slightly less than the Jews, within a few years, given their tremendous birth rates, they would be a majority, and therefore there would be no state of Israel. There would be no Jewish state. You're not facing the reality. You're just talking in principles which do not match reality.
Ned, one last quick question.
Do you
understand Benny Morris's and Jews, it must be said all over the world, their deep concern that there be a Jewish state, and that that even the numbers that you speak of could mean that 10 years on, the Jewish character of Israel would no longer exist?
The Jewish character was in danger in 1948 if the Palestinians hadn't fled, because they were a larger percentage of the population, and this was at a time Israel didn't have nuclear weapons and international recognition.
But Ned, the point is, do you understand Benny Morris's concern?
I understand, but that doesn't...
How would you acknowledge it?
Many of the refugees returning would opt, let us say, not for Israeli citizenship, so they wouldn't vote in the Knesset. They could be citizens of the Palestinian state.
Ned, we're down to just less than 2 minutes, and I'm going to thank you for your call, and I'm going to turn to Shibli Telhami for a final thought.
Well, and I think that, the starting point, as I suggested, is that, if you're talking about negotiated settlement in this generation, which I hope we will have, would be based on two states for two people. It's a nationalist framing of the conflict. It is a compromise. It is a Palestinian state to reflect Palestinian nationalism. A Jewish state with a Jewish majority, robust Jewish majority. I think that's clear. The way to resolve the issue is to address all of the emotional, legal, psychological aspects in the context of this practical compromise, and not have forcible solution, to have options. The options would be for the Palestinians to have a compensation package, settlement in a new Palestinian state, settlements in some Arab states, immigration to some countries, plus being part of a lottery to go to Israel that according to a quota that is agreed upon. And so in that sense, you would have all kinds of options for people to choose. And I think the practical implications would be that you could have exactly what people who want a negotiated settlement want, a state for the Palestinians, a state of Israel to reflect Jewish nationalism.
Well, that could be a starting point for negotiations when the heat cools down, as we all fervently pray it will, sooner rather than later. Thank you, Shibli Telhami. Shibli Telhami, the Anwar Sadat Professor for Peace and Development at the University of Maryland. Thanks also to Benny Morris, who teaches history at Ben-Gurion University in Beersheba. And earlier this hour, we spoke with Ghassan Al-Khatib, the Palestinian Minister of Labor, and Gabir Suleiman, Palestinian refugee who lives in Sidon, Lebanon. Our senior producer is Tara Murphy. I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is The Connection.